Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. It's a cold day in New York today. It's about 18 degrees when I woke up this morning. A little windy coming over here. We're back into winter. We had a few nice days. Today is episode 95 of Feast Your Ears, and I have Michael Moses Leshinsky joining me by phone. Michael is a bladesmith and knife maker based in Ashland, Oregon. He's been making knives and other cutting tools full-time since 1980, and I'm really pleased to have him join me on the show. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Good to be here. Yeah, so I imagine it's not quite as cold in Ashland as it is in New York today.
It's like spring out here. We have a microclimate here in this mountain community, and it's been a very mild winter, which NOAA predicted years ago, that winters here are going to get milder, a little more like Chico. And so it's sunny and almost 50.
Oh, nice. Beautiful. I've been to Ashland a couple of times. I lived in Northern California in the 90s and would make a trip up there to go to the Shakespeare Festival in Ashland.
Yeah.
My last experience in Ashland, I think I dropped acid on the way there to the Shakespeare Festival.
I never did that.
Do they still have the Shakespeare Festival out there?
Oh, yeah. It's going strong. It's definitely the center of the city.
Cool. And so, I'd love to hear your story kind of starting from the beginning. So you're actually a Brooklyn native.
Yeah, I grew up, believe it or not, in Trump Village.
Ah.
My mother worked for his father, and they actually were pretty good to her.
Ah.
I have to admit that they were pretty nice to her when she left in, I think it was 83.
Yep.
They gave her a chunk of money because they wanted to. Their father did, Fred.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was well known as Avance and, immature, and
yeah.
I was shocked that he became president.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely have heard from other people that knew his father that, his father was actually a fairly good employer and actually did right by people. And unfortunately, yeah. I guess the apple falls far from the tree in that case.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I remember they would give me tickets to the Knick games, and my mother and I would go. Which was very generous of them. And she would sometimes tell stories about the Donald, but he was kind of on the periphery. Fred was pretty much dominant in the mid-60s, late 60s. He was kind of just doing his thing. So I left in Brooklyn in 77 after I finished my master's degree and moved to a commune in Southern Oregon, not far from here.
Okay.
Where I learned to grow food and, basically all about living on the land in a full-on commune with 10 people and 4 kids.
Wow.
And the blacksmith lived next door.
I
met him because he would come up in the wintertime. He refused to use electricity. He wouldn't drive. So in the wintertime, he got pretty cold sometimes. So he would come up to our place and... I learned to cook there. He would come up when I was cooking and we would talk a lot. He was, he had a master's degree in musicology from NYU and he was a good man. And, when I decided to leave the commune, he said, well, you want to try and be my apprentice?
Wow.
That's,
I mean,
within,
that sounds like an amazing.
A few hours, I fell in love with it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like an amazing offer to have access to that, I mean, in a day and age where things become sort of, we become further distanced from working with our hands, I feel like, you know, every yeah. year that you had the opportunity to really have an old school style apprenticeship with somebody.
At the time I was 29 and, we just laughed a lot, and I spent a year with him and continued on afterwards developing my craft until, 35 years later, it just got finer and finer.
Sure.
And I think the turning point for me in my career was when the New York Times article came out in 2001.
Yep, yep.
And within a day, I had over 500 orders that took 3.5 years to fill.
Wow. I mean, it is amazing how once that press comes along, I mean, I feel like, I think Bob Kramer has a similar story about, you know, just sort of doing his thing and working on his knives himself. And then I think it was Sever in his case, or maybe Gourmet, that ran an article about him. And then suddenly, same story, he had notebooks full of orders that he, you know, took years and years and years. So I'm curious to know, you started out making, you didn't start out making kitchen knives though, correct? You started making wood tools?
No. In those days, all this man did without electricity, and when he wasn't horseshoeing, was doing whatever came through the shop door.
Wow.
He just made stuff and sold it sometimes at fairs. And so basically what I was working on was basic Ford skills. I worked with coal, but no electricity. You know, the hand crank drill and everything had to be forged by hand. So I developed a line of called house jewelry, sold for people for apartments, farms, ranches. Well, I made probably over a 5-6 year period hundreds of things, from surveyor stakes. You know, a local surveyor wanted 300 pointed rebar stakes to dinner bells to really fancy dinner chandeliers.
Right.
But then that followed up into tools, woodworking tools, and made of carbon steel, and then that morphed into kitchen knives.
Got it. And that's really where what you're doing now full time is kitchen knives.
Yeah, I've been doing that for many years now. The last year, I've been working collaboratively, luckily, with a neighbor who is a master cabinet maker, a German trained, really talented cabinet maker, and we've been doing steak knife sets for high end Michelin starred restaurants.
Yeah, I saw some of them on your site. They're beautiful, and the boxes that they come in are really, really fantastic.
Yeah, we're just actually today doing a photo shoot for some work we did collaboratively for a restaurant that's opening in, I don't know where it is, in San Francisco, Soma. I don't know if that's familiar to you.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
It's called Birdsong, and the chef is Chris Blydorn, who used to be with at Atelier Kren.
Nice.
We worked for Atelier Kren and did a concept steak knife set for them. And then he took it even further with 25 steak knives, 5 carving knives, and then a chest with trays that will go to the tables.
Oh, beautiful.
So today the knives meet the chest, and we're going to do a photo shoot, which is pretty exciting for me. It's months of work.
Yeah. So, you know, I know having looked at your site, and, you know, people should check out wildfirecutlery.com to find out more about sort of your process. But it appears from your site that the bulk of the work that you do is actually custom, like you're talking about, and not just sort of stocking up on 8-inch chef's knives that you have in stock to sell people. Is that correct?
Yeah. What's happening is that in order to be able to do my work, I need to be in sort of some kind of decent shape. I can't take a month off and then expect to. I'm 67 years old, so I can't take a month off. It's going to be hard to go back into it. So years ago, I decided that I need to stay busy on a semi-regular basis. So if I don't have any custom work, I decided I was going to do an in-stock now page so I could work on my own work.
Yep.
So I could do my own designs and not just work designs from people. I did that so that I could work all the time and stay in shape.
Yeah.
But it turned out that at the same time, I was able to develop new designs, work with different thicknesses of steel, and it just took off on its own once I decided I was going to put energy into it. But the custom work, like, for instance, I just did a commission for a man in Adelaide, Australia, who Richard Holston, who owns a department store chain there. And he wanted this kitchen knife with everything in it. And he enjoyed the process of collaborating on design, and so do I.
Yeah.
So we hit it off, over email, and it was a blast working with him. He was a great guy, and he loved the knife. He just loved it. He's going to want more.
I mean,
and
you know,
that's how it always goes.
That's such a wonderful connection that you get to have to the customer and to the knife and the customer to the knife. I mean, you know, I ran a retail shop called the Brooklyn Kitchen for years. We sold lots of knives. I also was in the antiques business for a long time. So I have a personal collection and have sold lots of vintage knives. And I love when I find, you know, an antique knife, because the idea of figuring out, okay, it's a, you know, it's either a Green River, you know, Russell that I know was made in Massachusetts and I know where that came from, or it's a French Sabatier from the early 20th century. And just thinking about what are the stories behind that. I mean, that unlike a lot of things today, knives included, you know, if you go to the store and you buy a Wusthof, it's going to cut your carrots, but you don't have any connection to the person or people who actually made that.
Yeah, it's a tool. Basically, what you're talking about is tools. Men love tools, and tools are cool. And, you know, tools, all tools especially, have stories.
Yeah.
And some people, they get tools that are just thrashed. And I've also been doing some restoration work for a couple of museums and for individuals who got a set that were kind of trashed. Mm. And you know, we decide, you know, we're just going to make them like new again, and they're like new again.
Yeah.
I mean, they still work great.
Absolutely. So, I mean, now at 67, do you have an apprentice who's sort of coming up and you're teaching your craft to?
No. Years ago, what has to happen is that, you take on someone who's experienced with what, say, I would have to take on someone who's already experienced with high-speed machines and forging carbon steel, and who has $15,000 in a year to set aside to work with me.
Right.
And about 10 years ago, I had my last apprentice, and I realized that I don't need it anymore. That's why I mentioned the New York Times, because that pivotal time meant that suddenly, besides the money that came in, I got a name. And you don't know you got a name until people start getting in touch with you from all over the world.
Right.
I mean, from, you know, I mean, it was amazing. And the web came just exactly that time. I just finished my website in 2001. So, it was like a lucky thing. I mean, it was just a thing that, it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
But so now I get people who want to collaborate, who have money, who want to, you know, beautiful things, and I get to take my time and nobody rushes me anymore.
I mean, speaking of the collaboration and what people are bringing to the table with what clients want, I noticed on your site some beautiful knives that include, you know, really high-priced materials. I mean, carbon steel in and of itself is not super high priced when you compare it to a lot of the sort of fancier, stainless alloys out there. But I saw some knives you made that include sterling silver in the handles, malachite, other semi-precious stones. So is that part of what's coming from those clients when they call you up and they say, listen, I really want this to be a top-notch object?
Right. A guy got in touch with me who, I'm not going to say what company it is, but he was the lead. He's the lead software engineer for probably one of the biggest search engine companies in the world. And he's autistic and he's homebound and he loves tools. And he did all kinds of research into my work and materials and wanted me to wanted to work with me on designing a set with him. And he, got ingots, silver ingots cast in Rhode Island to my specs. Hmm. This is a collaboration from a dream collaboration. He got custom-made malachite billets made, and he sent them to me, he sent me a lot of materials, which I actually was able to turn into knives also. Hmm. But and he was willing to pay for all the development, and he ordered a box too, a very fancy box that took 6 months to design. He was very into getting just what he wanted, and that's what I mean by people who can afford it, who just want. This is just what I want.
Yeah. Well, and it really then becomes something that, you know, can really become a family heirloom, for those people. And you're talking about a tool that, if well cared for, will last a century or more. I mean, there's really no reason that the average person, I mean, certainly, you know, chefs do certainly, they beat up on their knives, but they also probably use their knives about, you know, 50 times as much in an average week as the regular person. So they're using that blade, they're sharpening that blade, removing material. Whereas in the home kitchen, I mean, even people who cook a great deal at home probably aren't using their knife realistically more than 4 hours a week solid. You know, it's not, right. They're not cutting a lot.
Yeah. And you actually, your emails to me made me really think about what developed my cooking at home. And, I actually went back to this time at this hippie commune, where I had one day a week working on a cook stove. You have to get up and cut your own wood and, work on a giant wood cook stove. You have to bake bread if you want to make chicken soup, which I did a lot of, being Jewish.
Yeah.
And it's the only recipe my mother gave me. kill the chicken, butcher it, cook it all day on the stove. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I never really thought about that before. I appreciate you asking me about that, because that really did affect me.
I mean, it sounds very much the same as the chicken soup recipe in my family. My dad's grandmother was Hungarian, and her recipe started, first you steal a chicken, but basically the same. So going back to cooking, actually. So, I mean, you know, you've talked quite a bit about the historic or sort of, you know, pre-electric, pre-industrial nature of a lot of, you know, your life previously. I assume you use electricity now and have, you know, some of the modern comforts in your shop and in your home.
Yeah, I electrified in 82. I was lucky enough to meet some people in another Oregon town who said, we'll give you a free shop at the back of this barn. We have 350 sheep. You can live in your dome. I lived in a dome in this field, and they said, just keep an eye on our sheep. So I did shepherding stuff for them for a bunch of years, and I had electricity there. So I electrified. Luckily, I met a man who I became friends with, and he helped me develop the machinery to grind and buff and my tools and knives.
Yeah, I was very interested. On your site, you describe setting up what to me sounds very similar to, you know, a 19th century factory, where you have a single motor driving a single drive shaft with lots of different things on it.
Right, a line shaft. Yeah. And that was all built by hand. And what it turned out to be was just spending time with this man. You know, I never really, my father was always very, he was emotionally dead and distant. And so I never got that dad time. And this man, I realized, provided a lot of that. He was a good man. And he taught me a lot about welding and, you know, just being a good person. And I wound up at the end with this beautiful line shift, which I never could have conceived of. Mm. So that's where I learned to collaborate. You know, I realized that collaboration is important creatively, and I enjoy it. So it really was natural here in Ashland to meet the cabinet maker's name is Jens Sem, S-E-H-M, Jens. It's a German name, and we've been collaborating for 15 years. Whenever the opportunity comes up together, and both our work shines because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's nice to understand that so much of your work is driven by that collaboration, whether it's with other craftspeople or with your clients, and that's what makes the work interesting, rather than just saying, all right, I got to make 10 paring knives today and I got to make 2 cleavers. And that doesn't sound that exciting. That's really like working in a factory, right?
And many chefs that I deal with from around the world, say the same thing, that they're pretty isolated in their work, and to be able to take their skills, their experience, and their know-how and put it into a project with someone else who's just as skilled and collaborate and make something really beautiful and functional out of that is just taking it to another level, which is just sensible. It just makes sense.
Yeah, very cool. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about carbon steel and why you work with that as your blade.
Okay.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. And if you're just joining us today, I have Michael Moses Leshinsky on the phone from Oregon. He is a knife maker, tool maker, and has been making knives and tools full time since 1980. I think it's awesome, Michael, that you've been doing this so long. I think, you know, especially living in Brooklyn in the last 10 years or so, there's been a huge return of people being interested, I think, in artisanship and in craftsmanship. And, you know, people get a lot of credit and a lot of buzz around these things that sometimes I think are people just kind of fooling around, to be honest. And so I think it's really, you know, it's incredible. And I applaud you for having really, you know, you're doing it not because you want to be on Instagram and because you want people to follow you and you're selling stuff on Etsy, but you know, you've been doing this longer than some of these kids have been alive, honestly. So,
well, it's a lifestyle choice. It goes with my personality, you know, the with my karmic arc.
Yeah.
It fits right in with where that's at, and there's no way around it.
Yeah. So on your site, you say, I only use carbon steel for obvious reasons. And as someone who has worked with knives and sold knives and actually made some knives myself, I know what those reasons are. But I would love to hear from you. You know, what is the reason that you only work with carbon steel?
Well, my first experience with carbon steel was watching this was 81, watching the master blacksmith. He did two projects in a row, which, you know, he just walked in and said, I've got to make this set of nippers for an elephant. And, you know, I don't know if you know what a nipper is, but it's a blunt-edged tool that you can use on a horse. Most of them have an inch and a half wide head.
Okay.
This one had 4-inch head.
Wow.
And he spent hours forging out this, out of tool steel, this thing, and then he polished it up. And I didn't realize, when it came out of the forge, it was black, and we didn't have polishing tools, and he used a file to clean it up, and I saw underneath it was silver.
Hmm.
And, you know, this was an old Model A spring.
Oh, okay.
And then a little while later, the next project he did was a knife, where he forged a Bowie knife for this guy who was there, and then the guy took it home, and he brought it back the next day fully polished. He did it by hand.
Wow.
And I was just gobsmacked. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, so when I was thinking of expanding from just forging mild steel, one of the things I thought about was making wood carving tools because I like wood carving. And, you know, the natural thing to do would be to use carbon steel. Nowhere in anywhere of tool making or anybody that I met who made tools, no one talks about stainless steel. That was just, you just don't use it. It's just not there.
Yeah.
It's just not a part of anything. It is for, you know, mass production, but, you know, when you're making handmade tools, carbon steel is the best steel. because it goes in the middle of the road, sort of like a doused steel.
Yeah.
It's not too hard and not too soft.
Yep. Yep. And I find, I mean, having sharpened knives made of all kinds of different steel, I love the way that your 1084 or your 1057 or 1056 takes an edge. I mean, it takes yeah. such a keen edge that you can take, you know, I mean, you can take a carbon steel paring knife and you can put an edge on that you can use to shave with. And you can't do that with a stainless.
Right. Well, you could if you wanted to put the time in and you knew how.
Sure.
But most people who get in touch with me who want me to work with them, they're just so frustrated with stainless steel, mainly because they don't know how to put an edge on it. You can put an edge on it, but it's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, stainless steel is like a rock.
Yep.
I make stainless steel bolsters, and stuff is like working on a rock.
Sounds like the malachite's probably easier to work with.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, how many knives, and I know that it takes a different amount of time based on size and shape and things, but on average, how many knives do you make a year?
Oh, it all depends. I really would not answer that.
Yeah.
I don't have a handle on that. I really don't know. I don't know how to answer that.
I mean, I guess
I can barely remember what I made last month. All I'm doing is focusing on what's happening right now.
Sure. I mean, I guess what I'm sort of getting at is that I want listeners to understand that, you know, the making of a knife is not, it's not a simple or necessarily fast process, and that it really does require physical labor, you know, from somebody. I mean, that's what I'm sort of getting at. So, you know, I'm curious.
I can average one or two a day. I used to be able, when I was in my 40s and 50s, I used to be able to make three and four a day or more. Mm. But now I average about one or two a day, and that's a full day. And in addition, the work is very dangerous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you're working with high-speed machines and edges, you've got to be very careful and aware of what you're doing. And environmentally, you've got to wear a full face mask and gloves and cover my ears.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's loud for sure. working in those environments.
So, yeah, you know, and I can take my time these days. So, you know, I can take time off in the middle of the day and eat lunch or do something.
Cool. And so do you work in the shop? Are you there 5 days a week, 6 days a week?
Generally these days I'm producing 4 to 5 days a week. I try to take off at least a day or two a week, and I save, I like to cook, and I like to cook once a week for the whole week. And so today is my day. I'm going to make ramen soup and with handmade noodles. And so I'm going to take the day and, you know, do household chores and et cetera.
Are you following the recipe in that great video you sent me of the Chinese chef hand-pulling those noodles?
Weren't those great?
That was amazing. It's a wonderful, wonderful video. I'm glad you turned me on to that. I don't speak Chinese, so I don't know her name or what the YouTube channel is.
Me
but
neither.
The link was incredible. But I'll try. Hopefully we can put it. Maybe we can link to it off of the show page when this show is up online.
Someone sent that to me from Singapore.
Oh, wow.
I did some work there for a restaurant called Burnt Ends. Hmm. I'm an Australian chef there, and he sent me that video.
So, you know, so today's your day to cook. And so what are you working on in your shop now? I mean, do you work on knives as an assembly line, or do you do one knife at a time, start to finish?
Oh, only one at a time. After the Christmas, I usually sell out on everything that's available,
okay.
You know, to sell immediately. So just yesterday I finished a 9-inch by 2.5-inch kitchen knife and a 2.5-inch by 8-inch cleaver. I made them two together and they match. And so I don't photograph them. I scan them and I put them up on my site to sell now. And pretty much I'm in full stock on that. So next project we have to do the photography session for the Birdsong collaborative project this afternoon, and then I'm kind of open to what to do next. It could be any number of things, from working on machinery to I might make a Metaluna. I know many designs. I've been intrigued by developing a new recipe for clients for their own finish for knife handles at home. So I might make a video on that of olive oil and beeswax.
Ah, very, very cool. Well, we're just about out of time. Is there anything else that you didn't have a chance to cover that you want to mention? I mean, it sounds like if anyone's in San Francisco and will be eating at Birdsong, perhaps they will get to actually handle your beautiful steak knives.
Yeah, we also have steak knives on Lummi Island at Willow's Inn. Blaine Wetzel and I did some collaborative work a few years ago, and if they're in Singapore, they can go to Burnt Ends, Atelier Kren in San Francisco, and Birdsong. And they can always get in touch with me through my website. And, you know, I really appreciated reading about you and what you're doing there. You know, I haven't been to Brooklyn since 1988. I had no idea.
Well, you should come. It's a lot different than it was back then, I'll tell you.
Oh, my God. And it's very cool. I mean, it's really, really cool. I think I'd fit in well there. I'm not going to move back there.
But no, of course.
It seems very cool, and good on you. You know,
well, do great. Keep in touch. You know, if you are back in Brooklyn, it'd be great to see you. I mean, just to give you a picture, I'm sitting in the Heritage Radio Network studio, which is in two shipping containers in the backyard of a pizzeria called Roberta's that was built in an old auto body shop in Bushwick, on Moore Street off the Morgan stop on the L train. And this restaurant is packed every day of the week, if you can believe that people are coming all the way out here to eat pizza. So,
you know, as a guy growing up in Brighton Beach, I never even once went to Bushwick. I wouldn't even know it.
Of course, of course. Well, Michael, it's been a real pleasure. And I definitely want to just say again, people should check out wildfirecutlery.com and they can read more about Michael and his process and how to get in touch with him if you want to get some custom knives made.
One last thing I'll say is, if I get a lot of orders, I'm going to put up a wait list.
Sure, of course. Great. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Okay, Ashley, take care.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tatasciore, who engineers this show. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to like the show on your platform of choice, and please reach out to me if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me or message me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.